Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to the very first episode of Writers Aloud, a new podcast series from the Royal Literary Fund. The RLF is a UK charity founded in 1790 to help writers in financial difficulty. The need for support is just as pressing today, and the RLF continues to assist professional published authors with grants and pensions. It also runs a number of public education programs, principally in UK universities, where RLF writers, known as fellows, provide students with independent, one-to-one coaching in academic writing skills. You can discover more about the Royal Literary Fund at www.rlf.org.uk. Writers Aloud showcases the talented community of writers associated with the RLF. The series will offer a variety of writers' voices in interviews, conversations, and individual reflections. Unusually, the interviewers and producers of the series are themselves writers. We do hope you'll enjoy listening in. In this episode, we're delighted to feature Annie Caulfield on the importance of one shiny silver nickel and Ruth Thomas on how personal experience is transformed into fiction. First up, we have Annie Caulfield. Annie's a travel writer, dramatist, novelist and broadcaster who's written extensively for radio and television and lives in London. Here's Annie with The Nickel.
On my desk, I have a nickel. A shiny American coin worth 5 cents, half a dime. But I'm not going to talk about money. I'm a writer. How could I possibly know how to talk about money? No, when I see a nickel, I don't think money. I think a nickel for the movies. A nickel for the movies is, I'm afraid, a misquotation from Scott Fitzgerald's unfinished Hollywood novel, The Last Tycoon. The nickel occurs in a scene that is a very elegant and witty lesson on writing. Although the lesson is about screenwriting, every time I read those couple of pages, I'm reminded to remember what they tell me about how to write. I've misquoted, and now I'm going to paraphrase Scott Fitzgerald. That's how cheeky I am. So, in this scene in The Last Tycoon, charismatic producer Monroe Starr, Robert De Niro in the film, is in a confrontation with Boxley, a famous English novelist who is trying to write a screenplay. Boxley, Donald Pleasance in the film, tells Starr that his co-writers are dolts, illiterate. Starr stops him. Whoever's to blame, Boxley has handed in a scene that's just talk, back and forth. Outraged by Starr's criticism, Boxley points out that the characters are fighting a duel when the conversation takes place. In the end, one of the characters falls down a well and has to be hauled up in a bucket. Starr asks Boxley if he'd ever write such unnatural nonsense in a novel of his own. Of course Boxley wouldn't. Then Starr tells Boxley, imagine you're in your office, just staring into space, exhausted from writing, dueling, falling down wells and so forth. A pretty stenographer comes in. She doesn't see you. She takes off her gloves, opens her purse and dumps it out on the desk. She has 2 dimes and a nickel and a cardboard matchbox. She leaves the nickel on the desk, puts the 2 dimes back in her purse, and she takes her pair of black gloves over to a stove and throws them in. The phone rings. The girl answers, says, but I never owned a pair of black gloves in my life. She hangs up and goes to light the stove, burning her gloves. She still hasn't seen you, but you suddenly notice another man by the door, watching every move the girl makes. At this point, Monroe Starr stops the story. Boxley, like all of us, wants to know what happens next. Starr says, I don't know. I was just making pictures. Then Boxley asks Starr, what was the nickel for? I don't know, Starr says again. Then he laughs. Oh, yes, the nickel was for the movies. Boxley despairs, says he doesn't understand movie writing at all. "You will," Starr tells him, "or you wouldn't have asked about the nickel." I would urge you to read the real perfectly poised couple of pages. Scott Fitzgerald knew how to tell a story. He couldn't abide working as a screenwriter, but he understood it. A story in any form is simply the right arrangement of details, one now, then another, until we're fascinated. And no detail, not even one as small as a nickel, should be wasted. I doubt that a nickel, 5 cents, has got anyone into the movies for a very long time. But small as it is money. I know I said this wasn't about money, but maybe I lied. No, this is still about writing, really, I promise. About writing and being a writer. I wrote as a child, a teenager, a student, but I didn't really feel I could say, "I'm a writer," until someone paid me money to do it. Well, actually, it happened when I felt someone had overpaid me to do it. I wrote some jokes for a famous comedian, and he gave me a cheque that made my eyes pop out. He'd be touring the jokes for months, maybe end up doing them on television, so I wasn't really overpaid. But at the time, I was astounded. All that? For a few lines? I photocopied the cheque with his famous signature and sent it to my mum to show that I wasn't, as she feared, just living fecklessly on dreams of glamour. She still has that photocopied cheque in a frame on the mantelpiece. Take it down, Mother, please. So, I was being paid to be a comedy writer, but the next big excitement a few years later was when I was paid to write a book from my heart, close to the writing I'd done in my childhood bedroom and student garret for nothing. That felt a vindication. That was being a writer. I still have the distinction in my mind, the job writing for money, that's probably a little bit of my heart too, or I couldn't bear to do it, and the real writing, the writing I start for nothing on my own. This writing that I would be doing regardless, what is that? Escapism? Therapy? No, I don't pour it out. Increasingly, I fuss at it, draft and redraft it. I get to a stage where I think it's working, but then I go back to it and realise it's all just talking and falling down wells and hauling up clichés in buckets. It's hideous. So I start again. I put a new nickel on the table and think, what are you there for? Another reason the nickel is there, the actual nickel, that is, not the metaphorical one, is that it's American. My family came to England from Northern Ireland when I was 5. I think America has a far more magical status for the Irish than for the English. Our family had those whispered tales about great uncles who'd gone to New York, Boston, California and made fortunes or done something shocking and unspeakable. Not too unspeakable to be gossiped about, obviously. I grew up watching American television, American movies and then reading American novels. When I finally arrived in real America in my late teens, I stared at the customs officials. Here were actual people speaking with actual American accents all day. I was very lucky not to be detained for suspicious behaviour. During this staring at American stage, I was reading everything by Scott Fitzgerald, everything about him. All that shiny, blonde, tragic American glamour. I thought Scott Fitzgerald's life absolutely defined a writer's life. Luckily, when I was a little older, I realised there was far too much drinking, early death and general unpleasantness in all that, so I had to find my own definition. I'm still finding it. A big moment was realising that defining a writer's life was not about lifestyle. It's about the writing itself. I go over and over things, and when a piece is the best I can make it for that moment, then that's the definition for the moment. I've moved on, and I have to confess there's a lot about Scott Fitzgerald I don't even like anymore. That fanatical teenage crush of mine burnt itself out. It's not you, Scott. It's me. But whatever happened between us, I cherish those few pages of The Last Tycoon, where you write so perfectly about writing. More than all the dizzy, sunshiny glamour, that defines you for me now. Fitzgerald was falling apart, cracking up, as he put it. But he kept writing that last book, needed to write it, regardless. Never mind life, sanity, bank balance. On he went. On we go. Now, here's an interesting thing about the nickel. It's made of 75% copper, 25% nickel. And remember, it's worth just 5 cents. Because of changing metal values, it costs over 11 cents to make a nickel. In 2010, Congress passed the Coin Modernization Oversight and Continuity Act to economise on the metal content. But the legislative committee involved keep asking for more time, further studies to be done, as if no one wants to be the one to say, OK, what does it matter? Let's skimp on the content of this iconic American coin. No, what goes in is worth more than the recognised value, and that is how it has to be. What's the nickel for? It's for the movies, for dreams of glamour, and it's pretty much what a writer's life is like. What goes in is worth more than the recognised value, and that's absolutely fine. Now, you'll have to excuse me, I've left some characters duelling down a well and they're in desperate need of a rewrite.
That was Annie Caulfield with The Nickel. You can find out more about Annie and her work on her website at www.anniecaulfield.com. That's Caulfield starting C-A-U-L. Now for the second half, we have Ruth Thomas. Ruth is a short story writer and novelist and a creative writing lecturer at the University of St Andrews. She lives in Edinburgh. Here, Ruth shares her lime soda afternoons.
A few years ago, one April, I was walking down a street in West London on my way to an important meeting with my agent. Well, I thought it was important at the time. Anyway, I was at that moment teetering along that strange delusional tightrope, that peculiar knife edge between hope and fear that literary agents can provoke. My mind was this bright, buzzing thing, full of images of my soon-to-be-published novel, whether it was going to sell abroad, who might review it, who might see something in it, whether it would hit the big time. Like most writers, I'm a fantasist. Anyway, that's where my mind was that day. It was focused on nothing else except my novel, my meeting with my agent, and just being there, being present and a writer with a new book in London. I had my BlackBerry phone with me, a cast-off from my husband, who'd moved on to newer technology, and which I wasn't used to. I was a bit of a Luddite, actually, where BlackBerries were concerned. I certainly wasn't used to getting calls on one. And I was about 3 minutes away from my agent's discreet door, bursting with anxious optimism, when I was aware that the phone was vibrating in my pocket. Then it began making its cheery and very loud calypso ring. I fumbled around, pulled the phone out just in time, and pressed the green button. It was going to be amazing news from my agent, I was sure. It was going to be some fantastic report of a bidding war for the translation rights, or something about an audiobook, or maybe someone wanting to turn the novel into a film. It was going to herald the start of something very exciting indeed. "Hello," I said. "Hello, is that Mrs. Norman?" said a loud voice. Because Mrs. Norman is my married, unwritely name. I said. I couldn't remember who I was for a moment, what my name was when I wasn't a writer. "This is Mrs. Kelvin," said the voice. "Who?" "Mrs. Kelvin, from school. I'm currently sitting in a kayak inside a cave." And an image suddenly projected itself, all the way from the west coast of Scotland, onto the Notting Hill pavement where I was standing. An image of my daughter's large, super-confident teacher, Mrs. Kelvin, sitting in a boat, holding an oar. "Mrs. Norman," said Mrs. Kelvin. "Sorry," I said. "The question is, do you give permission for your daughter to come kayaking with the rest of us this morning?" I looked around me. London had somehow begun to recede. Something about the way the sun was shining through the leaves of the plane trees and down the pavement seemed to be evaporating, like a quickly vanishing sea har. I could almost reach out and touch it, but it was already leaving me behind. "Mrs. Norman," bellowed Mrs. Kelvin, "the line's very bad because we're in a cave. So do I have your permission for Charlotte to come kayaking with the rest of us? Would you like to speak to Charlotte? Here she is. Here's your mum, Charlotte." And there was a slight pause, a kind of rustling noise that sounded like the movement of a cagoule-clad arm, and my daughter came to the phone. "Hello, Mum," she said. And the transcendently sunny and magnificent houses of Notting Hill quavered and vanished. "Hello, lovely girl," I said. "So is it okay if I go kayaking? Because you didn't tick the box on the form, and everyone else is doing it." "Didn't I?" I said. "Well..." My mind returned to the picture of Mrs. Kelvin sitting in a canoe, capable, practical, resilient Mrs. Kelvin, and I suddenly couldn't help wondering why I was prancing around the streets of London at 11 in the morning, when my 10-year-old daughter was about to get into a small boat and go paddling down the west coast of Scotland. And I felt this strange twist of loyalties. "Yes," I said, "I don't mind if you want to go canoeing, as long as it's safe." "It's perfectly safe, Mrs. Norman," Mrs. Kelvin announced, returning to the phone. "You wouldn't catch me doing this if it wasn't 100% safe." "Well," I said, "okay then." And I said goodbye and pressed the off button. Then I put the phone back in my pocket and continued on my way. Not rejoicing, as Muriel Spark might have said, but feeling a little jangled, a little disconcerted, and most of all that I was somewhere that was no longer quite real. The thing about being a writer is you're part of the world, but you're also drifting around, looking at it. You're always at a slight remove. It's just a very odd way to spend your time. And when your children are young, they think it's perfectly normal that they've got a parent who sits at home making up stories. But then they get older and realise that most of their friends' parents have less peculiar and less precarious jobs, and it can elicit a variety of responses. It's impossible to divorce the real world from the fictional worlds you make up. I try to do this and fail, because all writing is autobiographical, at least to a point, and that means that you have to drag your family into it. Writing, of course, is always about making things up, otherwise the whole process would get pretty tedious. Writing without fabricating is just documenting facts. Even diaries and journals lie. Perhaps especially they do. But in order to make things up, you have to start with things that are real. You have to begin with events that happened, and sometimes conversations that took place. Then you can leap off into something that is make-believe and new. Somewhere amidst all this fabrication, I've learned to do something rather self-delusional, and I do it mainly for reasons of self-preservation and for the sake of my friends and family. For instance, I might give my main character a job which is like writing, but isn't quite. Maybe it's about drawing or sculpting or playing the violin. Or I might write about a son, not a daughter, or a niece, not a nephew. Or I might make up a name I wouldn't dream of giving my own child. Or set a scene in a kitchen showroom, not the plumbing accounts office where I actually worked. But these are all sleights of hand. They're minor tweaks. It goes without saying that my thumb is in the scales. But it's amazing how, by establishing your own set of rules or code of ethics, you can give yourself permission to write about something. You can believe that you're creating fiction rather than recounting fact. I suppose that's what fiction is. No more than a sideways interpretation of the truth. I think my children have got used to the fact that I'm a slightly strange mother who stays at home writing novels and short stories. I think, in a way, they're more used to it than I am, even more accepting about it than I am. When they were small, I managed to separate my writing life quite successfully from my life as a mother. I would write in the mornings when they were at nursery or school, and in the afternoons I would stop writing and do all the mothery things. I still do as much as possible, though now they're older something has changed. They know what I do. And I can't pretend anymore that it's not a bit peculiar. A couple of weeks ago something happened that somehow confirmed this for me. Fridays in Edinburgh are half days at school, and my 11-year-old son George and I have recently set up a new Friday routine. As soon as he gets out of school, we walk down to the Cameo Cinema, arriving around 1 o'clock, and eat lunch there in the cafe bar. Usually we have a panini or a bowl of soup, and George has a cold drink, and I have a coffee. We don't usually chat much. Quite often, I'll ask George what he's been doing at school, and he'll just say, stuff. He's never been a big fan of school. I never was either. But there's something really nice about going to the Cameo on Fridays. It's just one of those fleeting habits that you have to grab while it's there. Anyway, last Friday, we went to the bar, and George ordered a Tollcross chilli pie and a lime soda, and I ordered a goat's cheese panini and a cappuccino. And then we waited for a while in the dim light, beneath all the Cameo's posters of Hollywood film stars. We didn't talk. As usual, we sat there in a kind of companionable silence. So how was school today? I asked him after a while. What did you do?
Things, said George.
Things?
Yeah, things, stuff.
Ah. It took a while for our order to arrive. There's something laid back about the Cameo bar, which is fine by me. There aren't enough laid back places in the world. And then eventually it did arrive. Here you are, the waiter said, appearing at our table. This is for you. And he placed my mug of cappuccino in front of George. And this is for you, madam, he said to me. And he put at my place a very large glass full of lime soda. At least, I supposed it was lime soda, although it didn't look very green or very fizzy. It actually looked a lot more like Sauvignon Blanc. Maybe, I thought, there's a new, much yellower, flatter kind of lime soda that I haven't come across before. Maybe there's just a new, trendy lime soda that I don't know about. We looked at the two drinks for a moment, the two drinks placed in front of the wrong people. Then I said to the waiter, "Actually, it's the other way round. My son's having this, and I'm having this." And I swapped them over across the tabletop, pulling the cappuccino towards me and pushing the huge wine glass across to my son. There was a short silence. The waiter stood up straight, holding the tray flat against his aproned legs. "Your son is having the wine spritzer," he said. "Sorry?" I said. "That's a wine spritzer," the waiter said. "Oh," I replied. And I looked at the glass I'd given George, and I thought, the waiter thinks I've just bought my child a massive glass of wine, my 11-year-old son, at 1 o'clock on a school day in a Tollcross bar. A strange moment elapsed of absolute three-way incomprehension, and then my brain began to work again. "So, actually," I said to the waiter, "it was a lime soda we ordered, not a wine spritzer." And a look of immense relief passed across the waiter's face. "You had me worried there for a moment," he said. "I do apologise. I thought you said wine spritzer." "Ah," I said. "I'll bring you a lime soda." And he pushed the cappuccino back towards me, plucked up the glass of wine and legged it back to the bar. George and I didn't speak for a moment. We just looked at each other. And then he said, "Do you think you're right about this, Mum? Do you think this is a moment that will appear in one of your books?" "Well," I began, and I paused because the waiter had returned again with a tall glass full of green fizzy drink. "There, let's keep it legal, shall we?" he said, placing it on the table, and he shimmied off again back to the bar. "So," George said again, catching the straw with his mouth and beginning to drink, "is it going to be something you put in a book?" "Hmm," I said. And a little bit of me felt really sad that he'd worked out what I was prepared to plunder, what I was willing to remove from our private world and place somewhere public, like a jewel stolen by a magpie. But another part of me felt relieved, because he wanted me to nick that moment for a scene. He didn't want me to let it go, if I wanted to use it. I think it was the first time that I felt I had someone's blessing. I felt strangely forgiven, and happy that the lime soda afternoon will still be there, almost like a photo, even when he's old enough to drink legally in bars. "The difference between writers and critics," Grace Paley said in her talk, "The Value of Not Understanding Everything, is that in order to function in their trade, writers must live in the world, and critics, to survive in the world, must live in literature. Which is, I suppose, what I'm trying to do when I write, or at least how I try to justify writing about things that are personal, scenes that draw on memories of my family life. I try to live in the real world and to report it,
but also to alter it so it becomes fiction. Then I can look at it as something created, not purely autobiographical or stolen in some way. I've told them straight, those two stories, the one about the phone call and the one about the lime soda, because this is an essay, and there's something about an essay that makes you feel you should be telling the truth. It's felt strange being so honest, actually, which makes me realise how much of a fabrication my fiction is. How much I spend my time lying, in a way. But I think in these two cases, my son and daughter have given me their permission to tell the truth. George positively encouraged me to use that scene in a book. And Charlotte and I both love telling stories about the things that have happened to us. That's where fiction comes from. It's stories you bring home with you. We've both told our friends the story of Mrs. Kelvin in the canoe, so it already feels as if it's moved into the realms of embellishment. If I was writing either of those scenes in a novel, though, they'd be in disguise. It would be Miss Calvin abseiling up a cliff, and a glass of Ricard in a French restaurant. Which is what would make it okay in my book. Which is what would make it fiction and not fact. In her essay, The Nature and Aim of Fiction, Flannery O'Connor wrote, "I'm always highly irritated by people who imply that writing fiction is an escape from reality. It is a plunge into reality, and very shocking to the system. I suppose the trick is to make it not so shocking to the system that you can't continue to do it, which is where the little self-delusions and allowances and alterations come into it." By the way, the meeting that day in London was a bit of a non-event in the end. It was really just a cup of tea and a chat. A lot of important and famous writers looked balefully down at me from posters and photographs on the walls, reminding me of graduation photographs. I'm not sure what I was expecting, really. I left again about an hour later, back on the tube to my brother-in-law's house at the far edge of the Northern Line. The next day, I was on the train back home, making mental notes, because you really never know when an episode might come in handy.
That was Ruth Thomas with Lime Soda Afternoons. You can read more about Ruth and her work on her website at www.ruth-thomas.com. That's Thomas with a TH. And that concludes episode 1, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 2, we'll be featuring renowned poet Jo Shapcott, who'll be exploring the importance of sound in her poetry in conversation with fellow poet Julia Copus. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.